You're listening to The Money Hour with Mitchell and Mercer. Now live in the studio, local mortgage and finance experts Tina Mitchell and Mike Mercer.
Welcome to The Money Hour with Mitchell and Mercer, the Saturday, September 29th show. I'm Tina Mitchell, Mortgage Diva, and sitting to my left is my co-host, the Mortgage Master, Mike Mercer.
Hi, Tina.
Ready for a great show?
I am.
Thank you for taking time with us today to talk money. Mike and I are here every Saturday on AM 1090 at 3 p.m., where we bring into studio the best of the best experts in our local market on everything money. We're here to help you in today's economy. And Mike, for our guest today, we have in studio Karen Vincent with Morrison House Sotheby's International to talk about the luxury real estate market. So I'm excited to hear what's going on for people that have some money buying real estate in this environment. And I'm also excited to have Jeff Patrick with Sound Transit here to discuss the expansion that voters approved in 2008. New expansion plans that add Sound Transit Express Bus, Sounder Service, and 36 miles of Link Light Rail. So that's what we have for studio today.
Great show.
And it sounds like it's some time for Money Chat. Mike, what do you got today?
This is an article that was in CNN Money. Kind of a fun little article. Just says, it poses the question, what would you do if you had an extra $50,000 right now?
That'd be
so
nice.
Yeah, we all could use an extra 50 grand. But the article went on to kind of talk about a couple things, and I'll try to cover as much as I can, as quickly as I can. But the first thing would be, and this is really aimed, I think, more towards people that are approaching retirement. So one would be own your own vacation getaway. And the article stated that if you've ever dreamed of buying a second home, now may be the moment to take action. There are plenty of condos and small homes for sale in places hit hard, really hit hard by the housing meltdown. And many of these spots are coveted by leisure lovers and, of course, future retirees. So it went on to say that consider these three improving markets where 50 grand will give you a down payment of 30% or more. So the first place was a place called Lakeland, Florida. The median home price there is $104,000 and expected to rise 10.2% in appreciation by 2017. In Tucson, average price there is $145,000 and it's forecasted to gain 7.8% in the next 5 years. And then the third was Myrtle Beach, South Carolina, which is expected to see similar gains, and the median price there are even lower. It's $133,000. So the bonus part of this was they were saying that more than half of vacation homeowners bring in enough rental income to cover 75% of their mortgage. And this is a report that was done by HomeAway.com. So kind of interesting. And then it went on to say, you know, make sure that the kids are all right. So they're talking about taking 50 grand and maybe helping out with, you know, grandkids or really young children's college education. And it said that a new study from Sallie Mae had found that parents making over 100,000 or more could afford to shoulder just 52% of college costs last year versus 61% in 2010 and 2011. So want to help your grandkids and their parents with those tuition bills? Put $50,000 in a 529 plan. The money will grow untaxed and withdrawals are tax-free if used for education. Here are three low-cost picks according to savingsforcollege.com. All with solid fund options. So one was Virginia Education Savings Trust, the second was Ohio College Advantage, and the third was Utah Educational Savings Plan. So of course, our recommendation would be to speak to your financial planner about that kind of stuff. The third thing it talked about was buy a peace of mind cheaply. And this is a question that they posed to retiring people. Which do you fear more, dying or outliving your savings?
Outliving their savings.
Absolutely. Yeah. This is for 61% of the 44 to 75 year olds in 2010. The study showed that they were definitely more scared of running out of money. So the article went on to talk about, you know, longevity annuity, which means assures you of a lifetime of income in the future for relatively small premium today. Can help ease those worries. Just as an immediate annuity, you can fork some money out at retirement, say 10 to 20% of your savings in exchange for monthly checks for life. The other thing that the article went on to talk about was, let's see here, it says cash in on record low rates. And this, for people who currently own a home, it was making a suggestion that to be able to put a big dent in your biggest budget item, which would be your mortgage, when you're thinking about refinancing. So here's how a cash in refinance would work. It's a, let's say you had a $200,000 mortgage on a 30-year term at 5%, and you took it out 3 years ago, okay, by refinancing into a new 15-year loan. Recent average rates around 2.9% for the 15-year mortgage.
Depending on what they're paying in costs.
Yep. Mm-hmm. You'll save about 12 years off of the mortgage. So by putting in $50,000 on top of that principal, okay, so to reduce it by another $50,000, so you'll end up taking off $110 a month off your total payments and save about $124,000 in interest over the life of the loan. So anyways, I just thought kind of interesting. And then it goes on to talk about even to the point where if you're going to look to buy a car, because some people, if they had an extra $50,000, might consider that.
Yep.
Kind of went on to talk about some of the new cars out there that you can get the most bang for your buck. One was the Infiniti, the JX35 for $48,000. And they're saying with these car models, not only do you get the luxury, but you get all the smarts that go with it.
Sure.
So, and then the second thing was, I feel like
a nice GPS system,
yeah,
right?
I feel like we're doing a commercial for these two car companies. But the second was the Cadillac XTS, which is price tag about $50,000. And both of these vehicles get 31 miles per gallon, which I thought was kind of interesting. Mm-hmm. But anyway, so that's kind of what the article covered. Kind of interesting stuff, kind of fun.
So my favorite is the invest in the real estate, have someone pay for that home. If you can do a 30% down payment, get the taxes, insurance, everything covered, so you're really not out any cash flow. And then we've talked about it before, the wake up money, to where you're in a position that you can wake up and have money that you can spend because someone else is bringing it in. So that's building your investment portfolio. So I'm a big believer on that. I do want to make a comment on the refinancing and paying down the mortgage. You really want to look at the true cost of the interest rate. So if you're in a 25% tax bracket, that interest rate probably truly costs you about 2.24%. So meet with your financial planner and see on that $124,000 interest savings, could you really invest in and get that to compound and grow in another investment opportunity? So just some things to look at.
Yeah. And while you're talking to your financial planner about that, definitely look into this 529 plan.
Definitely.
Right? Because it sounds like if it's for the purpose of education, then you can pull that money out tax free.
Yeah,
so
absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah, great information, Mike. I also wanted to share during Money Chat the Mortgage Forgiveness Debt Relief Act that we're questioning whether it's going to be extended. And Mike, we've had a lot of listeners call in and email in asking if we feel that it's going to be extended. I don't know. I hope that it's going to be extended, but the act is currently set to expire December 31st of this year, but Obama's fiscal year 2013 budget proposal, it includes an extension for any amounts forgiven before January 1st of 2015. The act ensures that homeowners who receive principal reductions or other forms of debt forgiveness on their primary residence do not have to pay taxes on the amount forgiven. Now, housing advocates and lawmakers are worried that the exemption will disappear just as thousands of the homeowners are receiving large amounts of mortgage relief through the five largest banks. Now, we've talked about this before, the $25 billion mortgage settlement announced in February 9th of 2012 because of the foreclosure abuse that was going on. With this, Washington is receiving $648 million in benefits from the $25 billion lawsuit. So in these principal reductions, the modifications on their loan, if the Mortgage Forgiveness Debt Relief Act does not get extended, what that means to these homeowners is they're going to have huge tax bills. So you'd receive a 1099 for the negative amount of the responsible to pay on taxes, and your bank by law is required to provide the IRS form 1099C, and the 1099C will show the IRS the amount of debt which was canceled or forgiven. So if you own a $300,000 property and you decide, we're not talking about forgiveness in modification here, we're talking about a short sale, but same thing, if you're getting a principal reduction modification or if you're participating in a short saleability. If you sold your home for $200,000, the difference would be $100,000. So in a 25% tax bracket, this would cost $25,000. It would be $25,000 on that $100,000. So you'd pay an additional $25,000 in income taxes. Now, here, one of our CPAs that have came into studio before talked about not only the fact that you'd pay taxes on this income, but as well, it could put you in a higher tax bracket. Now, always when we give advice or talk about implications on taxes, you want to consult your licensed CPA. If you need a referral, you can always contact the show at 1-888-776-1090, or you can reach us online at themoneyhour.com. Now, under the act, the maximum amount of debt forgiveness is $2 million for married couples, $1 million if you're single or filing married separately. It applies only on primary residence, so it doesn't apply to second homes or investment properties, or for some reason you took a home equity line of credit out that was not used for improvements on the home. That does not fall within the act. And you still have to report the forgiven debt, even though you won't be paying taxes on it. So in today's political environment, the passage of any budget proposal could be considered doubtful. However, both parties seem to be in agreement that the provision should be extended, and we can only hope that it doesn't fall victim to the election year. So I'm still a little torn because with the act, there'll be homeowners that are going to strategically decide to foreclose on their property to take advantage of this opportunity. So I'm a little torn on that side of it. On the other hand, homeowners that benefit from the National Mortgage Settlement Act, and because of this, they're able to keep their home, making the economy stronger, making our environment and helping people. That's the other side of the coin. So right. It's going to be interesting to see what happens. What do you think, Mike?
You raise a good point. Like, what, given the option, what will people choose to do?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we could probably almost have a whole show just on that.
We absolutely could.
And I really think it comes down to how attached people are to the home that they're living in. I mean, I can see, not to say that this would be a fact, but I could see younger people maybe this still not being that much of a incentive for them.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas, you know, somebody else who's maybe older or has been in the home a lot longer and is maybe approaching retirement, the fact of moving again and all this kind of stuff, it might be a great opportunity for them. So it'll be interesting to see that once this actually does happen, what the statistics are on who actually ends up staying in the home and who takes advantage of a program like this.
So if you're listening today and you have any comments for the Money Hour with Mitchell and Mercer on the Mortgage Forgiveness Debt Relief Act, we'd love to hear from you. Give us a call, 1-888-776-1090, or as always, you can reach us online at themoneyhour.com. And coming up next on the Money Hour with Mitchell and Mercer, we have Karen Vincent with Morrison House Sotheby's International to talk about luxury real estate.
Baseball, the national pastime. It's basic, simple. In a time when, for a lot of Americans, many things are not. Your local Allstate agent can help make things a bit easier by saving you money on car insurance. Right off the bat, safe drivers can save up to 25%. Are you in good hands?
Get big league insurance for less. In Seattle, call Allstate agent Brett Stenmo first. Discount subject to terms and availability. Discount amount subject to change. Actual savings vary. Allstate Fire and Casualty Insurance Company, Northbrook, Illinois.
Do you have questions about money, real estate, or our local economy? Then don't miss the Money Hour with Mitchell and Mercer. Saturdays at 3 p.m. right here on AM 1090. You'll get all the information you need to know about what's happening in your local economy and the Seattle real estate market. Learn how to take advantage of that knowledge with expert advice and insight on how money and our local real estate market really works. We'll give you all the tools you need to make informed decisions, whether you're investing, buying, or selling. Listen to the Money Hour, Saturdays at 3 p.m., right here on AM 1090. This is the Money Hour with Mitchell and Mercer on AM 1090. Now, back to the show with local mortgage and finance experts Dina Mitchell and Mike Mercer.
Welcome back to the Money Hour with Mitchell and Mercer on AM 1090 every Saturday at 3 p.m. The purpose of our show, of course, is to help our listeners understand what's really going on in the local real estate market and financial arena. You can reach Tina and me at 1-888-776-1090 or contact us online at themoneyhour.com. Again, that's 1-888-776-1090 or online at themoneyhour.com.
And our first guest in studio today is Karen Vincent, luxury real estate market expert with Morrison House Sotheby's International. She has been chosen by the Seattle Magazine 2012 5-star real estate agents and is part of an exclusive group. Karen is one of a small group of agents in the Tacoma area that have sold a $1 million plus home since August of 2011 and is a member of the Pierce County Chamber of Commerce. So excited to talk about the luxury real estate market and what it has to offer.
Welcome, Karen.
Thank you. It's nice to be here.
So the first question I had for you was, in the greater Seattle market, what would you really consider to be titled as luxury real estate? Like, what falls under that category?
What we consider in the luxury market is more of the luxury lifestyle. We are talking about waterfront view properties, estates, ranches, gentleman farmers. We're approached by many sellers because of the Sotheby's global reach.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And because of that, we get the unique properties.
As far as the luxury real estate goes, do you think that that's also can be narrowed down to a certain sales price or price point? Like, is something over $1 million or is it 800 or is $1.5 million? Where is the price point where it all of a sudden becomes kind of luxury real estate? That's my first question. And the second question to that would be, is it also, you know, you'd mentioned earlier maybe views or the size of the land or the lot. So is it a combination of all that, or could you give a couple different examples of what kind of homes would fall into that luxury real estate title?
I'm mostly down in the South Puget Sound area, which is probably a little different than being up here in Seattle.
Mm-hmm.
Gig Harbor, we have, of course, a lot of waterfront properties, water view properties. And I think the amenities that we have to offer down in the South Puget Sound area, the private airports, our private marinas.
Yeah, that sounds luxurious.
It's very luxurious. And yeah. And down in, when you get down to the University Place, the Gig Harbor, the Steilacoom areas, and probably a lot of people don't know where that is. So it looks like Steilacoom, but it's Steilacoom.
Uh-huh.
We have many homes. A lot of people don't list their homes. I have a lot of sellers and buyers that I just kind of keep in my pocket. People have been so disappointed over the last few years that they've become very upset about mm-hmm. When they have their home listed, not a lot of looking over the last few years. And that has been an upset situation. What I'm seeing, the homes that were on the market for the last few years were priced for the market back when, the 2006, 2007, sure. the bubble. And those homes that haven't sold, that have sat on the market, are sitting and are upset. I call it an upset
sure.
listing. Whereas when people come to me now, you really explain, read the newspaper, you know what's going on. And yes, back in 2007, your house was worth $1.7
million. Mm-hmm.
Now it's, $800,000. And that's a bitter pill to swallow for a lot of people.
Well, and I always say you can lose big, but you also win really big.
So the only way
you lose money in real estate is you're forced to sell in a bad market, right? So if they hold on to it, when the appreciation comes back, they're going to win big. They'll make that up, no problem, right?
And then they can, when people are able to, I suggest that they do keep their current home and then buy something now because it's everything so low and the
sure.
interest rates being what they are.
So Karen, I know that Sotheby's, it's really unique in the company and what they have to offer to more of the high end and luxury buyers. Can you talk a little bit about the company and what services they provide that are unique?
We're just in a different niche and it's hard for me to speak about how other agencies, we get a lot of inquiries and clients that you never meet. That will purchase properties, usually for me, it's about, 30% cash.
Mm-hmm.
We get clients from China, Brazil. I will get clients in. I pick them up at the airport. We go looking, for 4 or 5 hours at different properties. Mm-hmm. They make a decision and poof, they're gone.
Yeah.
I guess I can only speak to, I can give you examples of, what currently we have going on in the market. Because we offer more of a concierge type hands-on,
mm-hmm.
I'm retired. I retired after 33 years with a company. I'm not pressured into my clientele, who I can take. I can do whatever I want for my clientele. I have a couple that they just, we helped them purchase a home down in San Diego. They got tired of the weather up here in Washington. We haven't put their house on the market, but we're going to.
Mm-hmm.
But their biggest dilemma is their cat. They have agonized moving because of their cat. Now, I think if you were, just a regular real estate agent, you wouldn't think that that was a big deal. To me, it's a big deal. These people are agonizing on what they're going to do with their cat. So we sat down, we had a powwow. I am going to be flying with my clients down to San Diego with the cat in tow. We're going to be met at the airport.
So that's concierge service.
That's concierge service.
That's what I'm going to do. When I get a call, a lot of our clientele, it's very discreet, mostly discreet listings, mostly discreet, buyers. When I get a client that we're going to go look at water view properties in our area, well, because of our lifestyle in the South Puget Sound, 50 feet from the foot of my home is we own part of a marina, a private marina. I get it set up that we have a catered lunch. I bring the clients. My husband's the captain. I'm the first mate. And we go out and we look at properties by water.
Well, I know you did. There was a plan for Anderson Island. Anderson Island is a neat little island here in our local market that has some amazing, amazing homes. And quite a few of those would fall into the luxury homes. And you did an actual tour. You do tours in special locations with unique homes, correct?
Yes. I partner with other agents because I feel it's really important. If you band together, I think you can do better. Mm-hmm. You don't have to be part of the same agency, but I put together an entire tour of homes with other agents, and we had folks coming onto the island. You know, the prices are great. Great for Anderson Island. It's very affordable now if you want the ferry lifestyle going back and forth. But we also have Ketron Island, which is right next to Anderson Island, and people get there by boat. They go back and forth by personal watercraft.
Nice.
That's the lifestyle. We have homes down on Day Island. We mm-hmm. have the islands. People have their boats that they, you know, motor around.
So, Karen, if somebody has a luxury home or a higher end property, are there strategies and different things that you would do in listing those properties than what you would do for a standard home?
Actually, all of the homes that I list, it doesn't matter if it's a $60,000 condo or a $6 million estate. They're all the same. I apply the marketing strategy to all of them. They all get my full attention. Because of the local MLS, where you list a property, you get 15, I think it's 15 photos. For every property I have, I create a unique website, and we have very high-end photography. Our photographers go in there, take very high-end. I do aerial photography. I do photography from the water.
Mm-hmm.
It's not typical. Right now, I have down in Steilacoom, which is a very historic area. I was contacted by the preservation committee because there was a little home, $1 million view. We're talking $1 million view for $129,000. It's 30 feet wide, and it was for sale by owner, and the owner is going applying to have it demolished. But this was built in 1860 by the Clendenden family. The preservation committee called me. I called the owner because I did a market analysis on it, and I told him, I believe the reason that you have not sold, that it sat on the market, number one, it's for sale by owner, mm-hmm. and number two, you have it priced under value. I told him that I thought that it would be in the $299,325 range. And he said, well, I'll list it with you.
Hmm.
So I am partnering with the preservation committee because we're really trying to, he's moving forward on getting the permit to have it demolished. But I'm working within our circle of global contacts for somebody looking for a historic property. And it's the ClendendenCottage.com.
Okay.
Okay. So what are there different challenges? What are you seeing as far as when it comes to getting appraisals, you know, on these higher-end homes? You know, Tina and I over the last couple of weeks have talked a little bit about the whole appraisal issue, values coming in low. What are you seeing right now when it comes to appraisals coming in on luxury-type homes? Has there been a difficulty? Have deals gone sideways? Have appraisals come in super low? You know, we know from a financing standpoint that on typically stuff that's over $1 million, there's going to be, you know, obviously two appraisals needed. What do you think about that?
I haven't experienced that. I don't have the problem with the appraisals with the higher-end homes. I'm having a heck of a time. The lower the home price, the harder it is. It's very difficult nowadays on the appraisals and even getting a buyer who's qualified. That's the very first step that, for some reason, the step goes, you go find a house, and this is what I'm seeing, and then, you know, I get called that, you know, maybe a $200,000 or $300,000 home, and mm-hmm. I'll ask them if they've been pre-approved, and they're, well, no, but we want this house.
A little bit of a backward. So if you're listening today right now yes. and you think of buying a home, the first step is you need to get pre-approved and then you go out and shop for your home. And in the higher end property, financing is a little bit easier when you're under $500,000. There's lots of opportunities with FHA financing and the lower down payment options. When you get into the higher end, chances are probably if you can afford those homes, you've got the ability to come in with money. You said you're seeing people coming in with 30% down, which is good. Minimum for jumbo typically is a 20% down payment. So it's good. The question that Mike was asking, asking about appraisals. It's good that you haven't seen challenges there, because sometimes I think some of the challenges in the higher end or the real luxury is just finding comparables, other properties that can support the value. So it's good that you're not running into any of that in your market.
Well, and I think another challenge is estates that I suggest that they get a professional appraisal to start off with.
Really good advice. Mm-hmm.
If they're dealing with an estate situation, you know, and they're talking about capital gains and you know, maybe a property was $1.2 million and now it's down to $800,000, mm-hmm. and, you know, the owners have passed. I think a lot of times to do the appraisal up front and then do your CMAs so you can... you know, you have your market, your appraised value, your assessed value, and you have to, you know that. You take
those. So good advice in doing that. Something to be aware of, though, if you do get an appraisal up front, that appraisal is not going to be the actual one that's used for lending because the appraisers are randomly chosen. Even the banks don't have control over that anymore. But it's nice to get a head start there with the appraisal. A lot of people we see doing that, sellers with the inspection, and it's just that next step up if you order an appraisal as well to make sure that that home is valued, and then hoping that the second appraiser that comes in is going to have the same opinion that the first appraiser did. What about expectations, Karen, from somebody selling? So if we have someone on the seller side and then somebody on the buyer's side, there has to be different expectations in that market from the sellers of what they're expecting from the potential buyers.
That has been the hardest thing. My heart just aches for the people selling now. The best thing that I can do for them is to give them facts and data, and to start off with that don't kill the messenger, that I understand that I'm in the same situation in my home. You know, we built a new home in 2006.
Mm-hmm.
I'm in the same boat. We're staying put right now, but we built our home for retirement. So the best thing I can do is to be as honest and upfront with my opinion to folks, and it's difficult. It's hard for people.
But it goes both ways, right? So they may come to you, and you might even point it out to them that their home was worth 1.2 back in 06 or 07, and now it's worth, you know, $800,000 or $900,000. But look, these people are selling. They're going to go buy somewhere more than likely, mm-hmm. right? Whether it's still in Washington or maybe they're going to buy out of state. You can easily show them whatever they're interested in buying, what it was back in 06 or 07.
Yes.
Right? So it goes both ways.
Well, and people are getting more comfortable. It's been a sad, all I can say is sad time. But now that, you know, if I can sit down and explain to them, get their comfort level, you know, this is what we're looking at, but look at what you can get nowadays for mm-hmm. your dollar. You might have lost some on this end,
yep.
but what you're getting over here, somebody who couldn't afford a waterfront property,
absolutely.
6 years ago.
There's huge opportunities in this market.
You can get a luxury property now where that wasn't possible a few years
right.
ago.
Absolutely. That's a great point. So again, if you're looking at moving up and you have to sell, it'd be the ideal thing, as you said before, Karen, is to hold on to your property, not sell. Unfortunately, not everybody's in a position to do that. So if you can't handle two mortgage payments, or you can't bring a renter in that's going to be able to cash flow that property, if you do have to buy and sell, now's the time to do it if you're buying up, because you're going to get an amazing deal. So just if you just take them back to 2006 and what it would have cost them then if they bought it at that time, and then you kind of have that aha. Oh, this is an awesome time to get into the market in those higher-end properties.
The people that are listing now, they have a realistic expectation of what they're going to get.
Mm-hmm.
So
sure.
It's listed today, it's sold today, because they're being priced to sell.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I'm seeing. I'm writing offers $5,000, $10,000, $20,000 over the asking price, and a property could have just gone on the market. They have three offers already. You don't get it. It's a hot market. The other thing I wanted to say is, in the situation where you want to hold on to your current home, I get tons and tons of inquiries for people to rent. So not only can I help people if they want to rent their home, mm-hmm. I usually have a renter for them, and it's usually a 3 or 4 year lease. And lots of times it's military down in the area where we are. So at least when they go in to get their financing, if they have a signed lease, then they can then look at a property. And again, to your point, that they can get a more expensive property than they could a few years ago.
Absolutely.
I was going to ask you earlier, what percentage of your clients are Washingtonians versus, you know, let's say out of state? You know, where do most of your clients come from?
I would say in the two to three $400,000 range. It's just local people who now want to move. They know the, like University Place, they have the reputation as the school districts are phenomenal there, mm-hmm. and as in Steilacoom. So people outside the area now see an opportunity that they can move into these areas where before they couldn't. They sure. couldn't afford it. The other segment is the military coming into the area. We have tons and tons of military, lots of doctors that they're looking to buy. And the other part of the military are people that are coming in to buy now and then renting and then retiring here.
Okay.
So, Karen, a takeaway. What would you give our listeners for a takeaway today?
We do probably twice a year. We have what's called our Art and Home event, and we showcase one of our ultra unique listings. This particular upcoming one is October 14th. It's at the Wurlitzer Mansion and Gardens in Gig Harbor. It's a 13-acre estate with three homes. The main home is a 17,000 square foot home that houses a turn-of-the-century Wurlitzer organ. It's actually to benefit the Northwest Furniture Bank, which is located in Tacoma. They have a retail shop and a furniture bank. And if you go to my website, you can see the information.
So, Karen, why don't you give our listeners your website?
It's uniquelykaren.com.
So again, that's uniquelykaren.com. If you want more information, you can always contact the show, 1-888-776-1090. Again, that's for the Art and Home event. It sounds like a great weekend trip to head out to Gig Harbor.
Thank you.
Yeah. Thank you so much for coming into studio today, Karen.
Thanks, Karen.
Thank you for having me.
And coming up next on the Money Hour with Mitchell and Mercer, you won't want to miss out. We have Jeff Patrick with Sound Transit. We're discussing the exciting new projects that will help our local economy and make our commuting life a lot easier.
Baseball, the national pastime. It's basic, simple. In a time when, for a lot of Americans, many things are not. Your local Allstate agent can help make things a bit easier by saving you money on car insurance. Right off the bat, safe drivers can save up to 25%. Are you in good hands?
Get big league insurance for less. In Seattle, call Allstate agent Brett Stenmo first. Discount subject to terms and availability. Discount amount subject to change. Actual savings vary. Allstate Fire and Casualty Insurance Company, Northbrook, Illinois.
Do you have questions about money, real estate, or our local economy? Then don't miss the Money Hour with Mitchell and Mercer. Saturdays at 3 p.m. right here on AM 1090. You'll get all the information you need to know about what's happening in your local economy and the Seattle real estate market. Learn how to take advantage of that knowledge with expert advice and insight on how money and our local real estate market really works. We'll give you all the tools you need to make informed decisions, whether you're investing, buying, or selling. Listen to the Money Hour, Saturdays at 3 p.m., right here on AM 1090. Now, back to the Money Hour on AM 1090 with your hosts, Tina Mitchell and Mike Mercer.
Welcome back to the Money Hour with Mitchell and Mercer on AM 1090 every Saturday at 3 p.m. The purpose of our show is to help our listeners understand what's really going on in our local real estate market and financial arena. You can reach Tina and me at 1-888-776-1090 or contact us online at themoneyhour.com. That's 1-888-776-1090 or online at themoneyhour.com.
And our next guest in studio, we have Jeff Patrick, the Media Relations and Public Information Manager at Sound Transit, which is operating the regional transit system of trains and buses serving more than 50 cities in the central Puget Sound region. He's been with the agency for nearly 10 years and was responsible for public involvement around the Sound Transit 2 ballot measures that 57% of voters approved in 2008. In addition to working with the news media, he is also responsible for the agency's Speakers Bureau and Information Center. We're excited to have you here today, Jeff.
Thanks for having me.
Excited for the topic as well.
Yes, yes. So you get asked this, I'm sure, all the time. What is Sound Transit?
Well, I guess I could give you
the breakdown.
The technical answer, and then there's probably the answer that how Sound Transit impacts people's lives. And that sort of depends on who you are and what you're doing and where you're going. But for a lot of people, Sound Transit represents a better way to live life than sitting in a traffic jam with your nerves getting frayed and then pulling into gas stations and filling up your car with a bunch of gas that you'd rather not be paying for. It's a way people feel good about their contributions to the environment because most of the state's greenhouse gas emissions come out of the transportation sector. But, you know, broader than that, it's also something, whether or not you use transit, that's benefiting us by creating a lot of jobs. The ballot measure voters passed in 2000 8 is going to create more than 100,000 jobs between now and 2023. And it also helps with real estate, an area of special interest for you.
Mm-hmm.
By, you know, in this day and age, people are choosing where they buy property based on where they need to go, because you can't just anymore, you know, plop down somewhere and count on the fact that you're going to be able to commute 30, 40 miles.
Yep.
You know, you're going to be putting yourself in a world of hurt if you do that, and then, you know, every morning, every night. So people are being strategic, and with transit, it gives you choices to live a lot more places than you might otherwise have, and get around without experiencing congestion, at least in the cases of light rail.
Yeah, so if you strategize, you actually want to buy that real estate in those areas now while the commute is a little more difficult before the improvements come in.
Yeah.
So, Jeff, how do the Link Light Rail and Sounder Commuter Rail services differ from each other, and where do the buses fit into the mix?
Well, yeah, you just rattled off our three primary transit modes, the two rail options as well as express buses. Light Rail is a service that operates currently between downtown Seattle and SeaTac Airport with stops in South Seattle, Beacon Hill, Rainier Valley, Tukwila. And Light Rail is the focal point of the ballot measure that voters passed in 2008. In the next decade, Sound Transit is working to build up to an additional 36 miles of light rail that voters approved. And I could talk a little bit about where that's going. Light Rail operates 20 hours a day, every 7 minutes during peak time. So it's a service where you really don't have to have a schedule to use it. You just show up at the train station, and the train shows up, and you go where you're going. And that stations are integrated into a regional transit system that also includes very strong local bus service. So once you to get to or from a station, it's really easy to hop a bus to get, you know, to your home or your business or wherever you're trying to go. Now, Commuter Rail, Sounder Commuter Rail, is an extremely popular service that operates on the BNSF-owned freight tracks. We have trains that serve our South Corridor. That's between Seattle and Tacoma, and coming up on October 8th, soon the long-awaited Lakewood extension is going to open.
Mm-hmm.
So the communities we serve in the South with Sounder Commuter Rail are going to include Lakewood, South Tacoma, Puyallup, Sumner, Auburn, Kent, Tukwila, and then up to Seattle. And in the North, we've got service that operates between Everett, Mukilteo, Edmonds, and Seattle. The commuter service doesn't operate all day. It focuses on the primary commute times. So there's fewer options, but it's a really great service for going a long distance. The third transit mode that we operate is express buses. And we run our express bus network in partnership with local agencies, including King County Metro, Pierce Transit, and Community Transit. And our service tends to use the freeways, the HOV lanes, for longer haul routes.
Mm-hmm.
And that service, too, is a really great option. There's a little higher risk on some of the routes that, depending on the time of day, that there'll be congestion in comparison to the congestion-free option that rail offers. But a lot of riders every day really get a lot of that ST Express system.
So, you know, over the years, there's obviously been some resistance. People have argued that, you know, we shouldn't be putting money into rail services, you know, in our area. What is your argument or the case for rail?
Well, there are a number of different ways you can answer that. I guess the first thing I'd point out is that very few metropolitan regions of our size get by without a major investment in rail transit. The real exceptions are Detroit was the main one, and mm-hmm. Cincinnati. So throughout the entire country, you really just can't find regions of our size that don't operate with rail. And so the light rail system that we started in 2009 now, I guess, puts us more in the league of our peers nationally. What you get with rail is greater speed, greater frequency of service. In the case of light rail in particular, you get greater reliability in your travel because you're not wondering whether a traffic jam or bad weather is going to slow you down, generally speaking.
Which it does a lot.
We all know that, don't we? You get a lot of capacity to move a lot of people quickly and at a with good operational efficiency. Then from there, of course, you get the environmental and economic benefits I mentioned earlier too.
I have a question. So in the future, or is it even realistic to think that there ever could be possibly rail that runs, you know, east to west?
That's a great question, Mike.
I mean, we have a big challenge in our, you know, lane in front of us. But
well, There's been a lot of debate about that over the years. There are failed ballot measures in 1968, 1972, but when voters approved the Sound Transit 2 package in 2008, it did include light rail across Lake Washington on I-90 to Mercer Island, Bellevue, and the Overlake area of Redmond. So we, over the last couple of years, working closely with our partners, including the cities in the east side, especially Bellevue, we've established a route to go from Seattle out to the east side, and we're focused on starting to get to construction of that in 2015 and to open it up for service by 2023.
That's exciting.
And then one other question is, now with the recent news about the new arena being approved down in the Soto District, do you see that would the rail be running through that area regardless anyways, based on the current plans?
We have a station that's located, what's called the Stadium Station, is located at Royal Brougham Way in South Seattle. So it'd be a little further walk to the new arena than it is to Safeco Field and CenturyLink Field, but still very much doable.
What about the expansions that are planned in both North and South Transit Pipeline?
Well, in addition to the extension of light rail to the east side, voters also approved extending it north and south. So in the north, actually, the original ballot measure that formed Sound Transit back in 1996, which is known as Sound Move, approved light rail up to the University of Washington. And we're already half complete building a subway system from downtown Seattle that'll go to Capitol Hill and University of Washington at Husky Stadium. So that's been pretty exciting. We just a few months ago finished our deep bore tunneling, and we're in the process of starting to build the underground subway stations, and we'll open that service. And
now those are exciting to see what's coming up with that. I mean, we've never had that, so it's exciting to see.
Indeed, we're really excited about that extension. That Capitol Hill and University of Washington areas are some of the densest areas in the West Coast of the United States, north of San Francisco. So it's a really rich ridership market. The University Link project alone is expected to generate about 70,000 riders a day on the light rail system.
Wow.
So in any case, continuing northward, the 2008 measure voters approved takes light rail all the way up to Linwood, and that'll include a further stop in the University District near Brooklyn Avenue, continuing north in the tunnel up to Roosevelt and an underground station there. Then the alignment goes at grade and elevated into Northgate and continues on up to Shoreline, Mount Lake Terrace, and Linwood. So the University Link, what we call extension to Husky Stadium, opens in 2016. We're shooting to get to Northgate by 2021 and up to Linwood by 2023, with some caveats about the significant challenges we have with revenues in the post-recession area that I can talk about in a little bit. So in the South Corridor, as I mentioned earlier, light rail currently serves SeaTac International Airport. The voters approved extending that further south to South 200th Street, to the Highline Community College area, and to Kent Des Moines, and all the way down to the northern edge of Federal Way. The recession's hit our funding in the South Corridor particularly hard, so I can talk about where we're at there. But we're positioning ourselves to start construction next year on getting it light rail down to South 200th Street. And then from there, we're going to study, similar to as we are up between Northgate and Linwood, looking at multiple route options for how to get light rail further south.
Speaking of construction, it sounds like there's going to be a lot of it. What are some of the biggest challenges that you guys are going to face ahead?
Well, I guess the biggest one is that challenge I mentioned with the impact of the recession on Sound Transit's revenues. Sound Transit, like all local governments, has been hit pretty hard. We rely heavily, as almost all transit agencies do, on a sales tax, and the recession hit consumer spending, and what that has culminated in is less money flowing to projects like the ones we've been talking about here. So cumulatively, the impact is currently expected to be a 30% reduction in funding compared to what we expected in 2008. So that creates a lot of challenges for us that we're responding to in a number of ways. The good news here is that with the amount of contingency funds that we included in our ballot measure in 2008, that's really helping us in our work to extend light rail as far as possible, as fast as possible. The first thing we did in response to the recession is to say, okay, well, those contingencies are gone now, so we're going to have to be a lot more careful in how we work on building these projects. We have had to do some cuts and deferrals of the projects that our board has deemed to be of a little lower priority in some of those rail expansions that I mentioned, and there are other options in the toolkit too. But the main paradigm we're in, though, is that of one where we really have to manage the projects well. back in 2008, we developed both a low-end estimate and a high-end estimate for what each project would cost. Now those higher cost estimates are out the window, and we're having to manage the projects to the lower estimates, and with those being a real hard limit on what could be spent if we're going to get those projects built on the timeline we're working for.
So, Jeff, what are the timelines for building the projects and starting passenger services?
Well, the Sound Transit 2 ballot measure was a 15-year package that was to conclude in 2023. And we are in a period of time where, with the recession impacts, we're going to be monitoring really closely over the next year how the revenues are doing. And one of the options in the toolkit, if we have to, is to delay projects because that allows for a longer period of revenue collection and creates more money. But at this point in time, we are still, you know, trying our very best to complete the major expansions by the 2023 timeframe, if at all possible. There's an exception, however, in the South King County area. The revenues there have been hit the hardest. I don't want to go into too much minutiae with you here, but Sound Transit's got 5 geographic sub-areas, and the money raised in each of those areas goes to funding the projects that are going to benefit the residents. And in South King County, the revenue hit is 41%. So we've got a heck of a lot less money to get light rail south. So as I mentioned briefly earlier, that we're embarking on a process to look at specific routes that we can use to build light rail south. And we're going to do that process to establish a route all the way from South 200th Street to the heart of Federal Way, even though the ballot measure didn't have the funding to go all the way to the heart of Federal Way even before the recession hit. When we do that, what we're going to do is get a better handle on what kind of costs we're looking at and what kind of options we're looking at. And from there, we can look at how to solve the challenge, and it'll provide a lot of light on that situation. It's looking like currently our revenue projections through 2023, the furthest that they would be able to get us by then would be the Kent-Des Moines area. So going south from there will depend on identifying future sources or taking longer.
How many riders do you guys anticipate will be taking advantage of these services?
Well, with all three of our modes, light rail, commuter rail, and express buses, we've got about 95,000 riders every weekday now. And in 2030, you know, in a period where our population is going to go up around about a third, we're going to be looking at having around 350,000 riders a day in our system.
Wow.
By that time. So that's a ways out there. So it's a long range forecast, but we're pretty confident we're going to be right up in that area.
So Jeff, let's break it down for the listeners on what these projects mean to our community that they serve.
Well, congestion free transportation, especially in the case of rail, you know, that whole business that so many of us know of, just sitting there in bumper to bumper traffic lurching forward. And, you know, in addition to taking a lot of time, it's hard on your nerves.
You get a lot older with that stress,
yeah,
right?
And you can't use that time to do productive activities in your life. When you're on a train or a bus, you can sit back and you can read a book. You can, you know, do some work. You can, you know, in many cases, you know, get that laptop up on a table on a commuter rail train. So it's just a whole different
head start for your busy day.
Yeah, it's a whole different lifestyle thing. That's an attractive thing, you know, for people who, as they look at their home buying options, I think,
mm-hmm.
you know, and so if I'm out there shopping for a home, I can tell you I'm going to have in mind where I need to go every day, and I'm going to have a game plan for how I get there. And more people are recognizing the ability to incorporate transit into their life plan,
well,
if you will.
A good realtor will tell their potential buyers that you need to drive that commute, because a lot of time a buyer looks at the home and what they can get 30, 40 miles out from their work, and you can get so much more home in a lot of situations that you really need to drive that during the commute hour to make sure you don't have buyer's remorse.
Yeah, so the investments that the region's making in transit
mm-hmm.
are
so a huge
enabling that flexibility. They're creating a lot of options for people that wouldn't otherwise be there.
Uh-huh.
So in the more urban areas, what does transit-oriented development, what does that necessarily refer to?
Well, transit-oriented development is kind of a buzz phrase, if you will, nationally for the demonstrated ability of investments in transit, and particularly rail transit, to spur positive, vibrant, high-density redevelopment in station areas. And more people are choosing that lifestyle of, you know, apartments and condos and dense areas where they can access, you know, a whole array of restaurants and entertainment and services in a dense environment that they like. You know, many people are choosing that. You know, it's not for everybody, but a lot of people find that as a positive thing. And so within a half mile radius of transit stations in those environments, what you see is a real catalytic role for transit and spurring and making possible types of development that might not otherwise have been likely to occur. So Sound Transit, the way we we promote transit-oriented development. Once we get done building stations, we have some surplus property that we engage in partnerships with other entities to put projects out for bid and to build transit-oriented development that includes, you know, housing like we're talking about, as well as, you know, other uses, commercial and retail uses in the same buildings. But probably the broader benefit of transit in those urban areas is what it enables in the private sector. You know, there's roughly 500 acres in that half-mile radius around a station, and so it's a real positive thing for those 500 acres to have more development options than might have otherwise been there.
And you and I were talking earlier, you had mentioned the Pearl District in Portland as an example.
Yeah, there are all kinds of examples to get held up, but for those of us who, you know, venture down down the road to Portland, Oregon, there's an area there that used to be just a bunch of old warehouses, but yeah, it's really convenient to get to and from there by both the MAX light rail system in Portland as well as their streetcar system. So those transit investments have been seen as playing a pivotal role in enabling the vibrant environment that's there now with a huge amount of restaurants and retail. And it's just a place that has drawn a lot of new residents and that a lot of people from outside that area like to come and visit.
Yeah, it's amazing what has happened down that area in the last 5 years and what it spiked in the real estate down there. It's like one of the premier places to live now.
Indeed.
So, Jeff, there's been some controversy around parking. Some people say that there's not enough park and ride capacity, while others say that parking's not a good environment for our neighbors. What is Sound Transit's response to that?
Well, we have made a lot of investments over the years in park and ride capacity, and we're going to make more going forward. But the reality is that at our current facilities, the vast majority of them, the demand is outpacing the supply.
There's not enough spots.
There's not. So
people what are you going to do?
Well, going forward, in addition to, you know, our plan to invest in more parking, we're putting more and more focus on making those transit facilities accessible by other modes, in particular access by local transit services. So you might get to a regional transit hub on a local bus, hop off of it and hop on a train from there or a longer haul bus. And, you know, also, of course, making those facilities accessible by walking and bicycling. Those are big ones too. And especially in those in more urban areas, you know, you see a lot of demand for, you know, people just coming on their own 2 feet or their own two bicycle wheels to those facilities. And it's a pretty exciting transformation that's happening.
Sure.
So where do you think Sound Transit is going to go? You know, what direction are they going to go once it kind of finishes all the projects that the voters approved back in 2008?
Well, that's really a matter that's up to the Sound Transit Board. We've got Sound Transit's led by an 18-member board of elected officials from around the region. And it's up to them to decide when they want to put another measure on the ballot for voters to consider and what the content of that ballot measure would be. There are issues that are out there as far as needing to have figure out what the revenue sources would be for that, since the tax sources we currently have are going to be tied up to a significant extent building and paying off the projects that are already approved. But in, you know, as far as the expansion of Sound Transit in the future, that we do have a long range plan that is out there, and the idea is that it's a plan that's going to get built out in stages, with our first ballot measure in 96 being the first stage, and then the 08 ballot measure, Sound Transit 2, being the second, and so Sound Transit 3. There's a lot of people that hope will realize the vision of getting light rail all the way up to Everett in the north, and all the way down to Tacoma in the south. And then there's a whole array of other areas where future light rail expansions can go that we're going to be studying. Those include out in the east side, you've got Kirkland and Issaquah, where there's, you know, a lot of appetite for light rail. In the Seattle area, you've got West Seattle, Ballard. So it really just remains to be seen what level of investment the public's going to want in transit and when they want to do it.
So, Jeff, can we go back to some of the benefits here? We haven't talked about employment opportunity. What do you see that Sound Transit might have for opportunity for employment?
Well, the Sound Transit 2 measure that we've been talking about overall is forecasted to create 100,000 direct and indirect jobs over the next decade. So when you talk about employment, there's a lot of stimulus to the economy that's going to come with those major capital investments. On a more sort of looser, more qualitative side of things, I would say that having a robust regional transit system, like many of our competing regions, both nationally and internationally, have that makes our region more competitive economically and for attracting high-quality jobs. Employers really want to be able to see that their employees are going to be able to get to and from work in a way that makes them happy. And so having those transit investments in place is going to be important for our economic competitiveness.
Good point. So I encourage, if you're listening today, if you want more information on the projects that are upcoming and the expansion that we have coming, go to soundtransit.org. It gives you all the information that you need. I liked looking at the photos. I guess it might be a girl thing, but yeah, go to soundtransit.org. You can get all the information that you're looking for.
So Jeff, what would your call to action be for people who are listening to the show right now?
Well, I guess just keeping it at the highest level, just ride transit. Give it a try. If you're not already on the trains or buses, see how it works with your lifestyle. And I think what you're going to see is that it's something that makes a lot more productive use of your time than sitting in a traffic jam.
Yeah, make your life easier. Save money. Help the economy.
Don't knock it till you try it.
You bet.
Jeff, thank you so much for being in studio here with Mike and I. We're excited for the new provisions and what's coming up in our next decade here for transportation.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks, Jeff.
And Mike, who do we have coming in next week?
Tina, we have two great guests. Next week, we have Inger Lawrence, who's with Windermere, and she's going to touch on how to physically prepare your home if you're looking to sell it. And second guest is James Einot, who is an attorney over in Kirkland, and he focuses a lot on estate planning. So he's going to kind of talk about the ins and outs of estate planning, give us a lot of good tips.
Sounds like it'll be a great show.
I'm looking forward to it. Yep. This is Mike Mercer signing off for the Mortgage Diva, Tina Mitchell.
And this is Tina Mitchell signing off for the Mortgage Master, Mike Mercer. Enjoy your weekend, everyone. Thank you again for being here with us this Saturday. And don't forget to come back next Saturday, same place, same time, 3 p.m., AM 1090. Thank you.
Thanks, guys.